the Best of the 260s edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, some of the best segments from the past 10 shows. Basically, we're dealing with the end of the world. It's going to be Ebola, the threat that really isn't dangerous to us, but we really need to worry about, and ISIS, something that's not really a threat, and we really shouldn't worry about it. In fact, our involvement probably makes it worse. But anyhow, let's listen to the Best of the 260s.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This is the Best of the 260s. Pretty much going to focus a lot on Ebola to start off with. Now, I've actually covered Ebola 3 times during the last couple of shows because it's become one of those evolving things that just when you thought something's going to happen or it's going to go away, it just seems to be getting worse and worse and worse. And, well, we're still not really doing all that much about it. But now it's kind of come home to roost to a certain degree, but not in a way that we should be really worried about. I'm going to do a bit of an update after we sort of recap what I have said in the past as part of this best of, just to assuage people's fears. So let's begin. Best of the 260s. This week's wine is about the end of the world, or one might think, based on the recent news stories about the Ebola. I say the Ebola because it's not really about the ongoing tragedy in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea, and now Nigeria seems to be added to this list. No, when it was in Africa affecting people there, killing people there, it was just the Ebola virus. Worthy of note on page 3, maybe a filler section on the National. That all changed, of course, when 2 white folk from the U.S. contracted the disease and were shipped to the U.S. for treatment. Suddenly it was front page, and lots of airtime on mainstream media circuits. I realized that it finally hit the populace when I heard someone at work state, straight-faced, that they heard it was a CIA plot. Oh yes, and when Fox News, of course, started blaming Obama for the Ebola. Of course, when it involves, quote, our people, and that is now on the shores, as in America, well, maybe we should forgive the hysteria. Of course, they only count as our people, in Canada at least, if you think of white folk as our people. But more interesting is the idea that Ebola has arrived in the USA. This is true in the sense that they are in US hospitals, but it's not like they caught it here. It's no more landed on our shores than pandas did last year. It's also an interesting side note that as it has been running its course in Africa, everyone was like, well, there is no cure, no treatment. Just keep them hydrated and comfortable as possible and hope for the best. Yet 2 Yanks get sick, and suddenly there's a drug that can stop it in its tracks. Okay, there are a lot of reasonable expectations for how we react, the experimental treatments and all that. And I'm not here to expose either hypocrisy or conspiracy. No, it seems that with all that is being said about Ebola, there's been a notable absence of real information. Should we be running for the hills? Is this the end of life as we know it? Let's start with, what is Ebola? Well, its full name is Ebola hemorrhagic fever, and like its name, it causes a fever. It first appeared near the river Ebola, and well, hemorrhagic means to bleed, so it's a bleeding disease. That is, as it takes over the body's cells, it overruns the immune system, generally making hay. And here I quote, it undermines vascular integrity. That is, the body loses the ability to heal cellular damage. Ebola causes cellular damage by using cell membranes to form virion buds, think baby viruses, and thus you start to ooze blood from your orifice, yes, all of them, as well as increasing the risk of tearing the skin and causing even more bleeding. Ebola is transmitted by, quote, blood and bodily fluids. Funny, they all talk about blood as though it were something other than a bodily fluid. But anyway, if you shake someone's hand or you just talk to them, no worries. However, if you kiss or come in contact with said fluids, well, no good news for you. Remember, the virus wants to spread. To help in this task, much to the detriment of the patient, Ebola causes violent vomiting and diarrhea, making it much easier, if not a lot more repellent, to come into contact with those bodily fluids. Ebola is a member of the Filoviridae family and related to the Marburg viruses. These viruses have as one of its defining characteristics, it tries to kill people. Well, primates, and we're primates. Ebola has several types that we know of, or at least that are responsible for major outbreaks. Sebov, one of the first seen in 1976, strikes Sudan and has also been seen in Uganda. BDBV, also seen in Uganda. And lastly, and most prevalent, is Zebov or Zaire strain, which is the current flavor ravaging Africa right now. There have been 28 outbreaks of Ebola since its first discovery in 1976, resulting in 1,700 deaths, prior, of course, to the current outbreak. Although it was mainly done its damage in Africa, both Italy and the U.S. had outbreaks, although in those places, only monkeys died, which were imported from the Philippines, another place where Ebola has killed off monkeys, but has yet to be seen in people. Well, so far, it's been reported that about 2,000 people have been infected. About half of them have already died. A typical mortality rate of Ebola is about 85%, so it's likely the death toll will rise. To get an idea of the impact of the latest outbreak, I should point out that currently, more people have been infected by Ebola than all other outbreaks combined. Holy crap! Run for the hills! It's the end of the world! Well, no. Don't panic. Relax. As I said, it's actually very difficult to be infected. Yes, when it first appears, there's a spike in the number of cases. But simple isolation is often enough to end the outbreak. That is why most of the previous outbreaks have body counts usually well under 100. Now you might say, well, Don, you said don't panic and followed up with saying something like, has killed more than ever before. Well, that may make us want to panic. Has the virus mutated? No, the strain of Ebola is the same that has reoccurred a dozen times before. So it's not the virus that has changed. But previous outbreaks had occurred in relatively isolated communities that could be easily quarantined and allow the virus to run its course. You see, another important factor in determining how an infection will spread is to know its natural host. In this case, it's the fruit bat. It's common practice for people to eat what they call bushmeat, but traditionally, this was a practice of the hill people, so to speak, not city folk. But the current outbreak has occurred in vastly more densely populated areas with a higher degree of interconnectivity. That is, what might have been a village treat has found its way into the city markets. On an obvious point, the possibility of it being spread increases with population density, so it spreads more quickly than previous outbreaks. This leads to a feedback loop. That is, the larger the area infected, the more spread out where the healthcare workers and their resources are needed to attack the outbreak. So instead of one village or one hospital to deal with it, you are now dealing with three countries, many cities, and countless medical facilities. As staff become spread out, they get tired, make more mistakes, leading to a greater spread, and another feedback loop happens. The more the doctors and nurses get infected, reducing the number of people able to deal with the outbreak, further thinning out the resources available to attack the epidemic. It is likely these feedback loops have caused the standard course of the disease to change. In May 18th of this year, the WHO predicted that the outbreak would be ended by the 22nd. Instead, you got a rebound and a new spike happening 2 months later. There were other factors that have allowed this pathogen to have greater impact than before. First, places like the Congo and Uganda have suffered several outbreaks. The people know what to expect and how to react. This is the first time Ebola has hit this part of Africa. This means that, for starters, people are reticent to stop traditional burial practices that include washing the body and kissing it as sort of a spiritual send-off. Both of these factors only help spread the disease. This lack of historical knowledge also leads to the bizarre, well, maybe being unkind, maybe not so bizarre effect that where you have family members hiding sick relatives for fear the, quote, spacemen might get them. You see, the early symptoms of Ebola are like a mild flu. So from their perspective, auntie gets a little sick, then these not African people dressed up in these white spacesuit type things take her away, and then they're told she's dead. It's not a stretch to imagine to think that the space people killed her. Ergo, next time you hide your relative in order to save them. Coupled with a society that is very distrustful of its government, corruption is rife, There's been civil and guerrilla wars. You take everything the, quote, authorities say with a grain of salt. Here in Canada, if a government official knocked on your door and said there was a health emergency and could you do X, Y, and Z, well, you'd likely comply. Not in this part of Africa, where distrust in government is high, and not without reason. Local tensions have gotten so bad, there are some cities where there are riots, where people have tried to burn down the hospital to, quote, free their loved ones. It has only been the efforts of police and other military officers that have kept this thing in check. Just the other day, all three nations mobilized their military to impose quarantines. They have closed their borders and are aggressively dealing with this sort of secondary plague, fear. We should also remember that the new potential hotspot for Ebola is Nigeria, with a population almost 10 times that of the combined current three nations under attack. Nigeria is also the place where polio found safe harbor as Muslim imams declared polio vaccination a Western plot to kill Muslims. What are they going to do if Ebola breaks out in strength there? So to return to the question, should we be worried? No. Well, at least not here. If I was in Africa, maybe, but not here. As you may have heard in the news, the moment a suspected case is found in Toronto, New York, what have you, they are quickly rushed to quarantine. A series of tests are quickly conducted. And so far in all cases, no Ebola was found. But if there was Ebola found, treatment and containment procedures would immediately be begun. Relative to the infected countries, our healthcare system is extremely robust and capable. Other factors that are hindering the decline of Ebola in Africa. We also have no natural reservoir. So the only way to get it is via a traveler. And again, because it's not easily transmitted, you're not going to get the primetime TV plot where someone on the plane is infected but unaware they are. You would know it if you were at least contaminated, as the transfer of bodily fluids, at least in this case, is frowned upon as communal activity. So not much to worry about. If you really want to worry, well, there are a lot more deadly viruses out there. Yes, 2,000 seems like a lot, but when you compare that to the measles, which kills almost 200,000 a year, or influenza at 500,000 a year, and of course the granddaddy of all, HIV, which indirectly kills over 1 million people a year, it doesn't seem that bad. And a bit of trivia. The disease most likely to kill you once symptoms arise? A disease that kills 55,000 people a year? Rabies, which has an almost 100% fatality rate once you start experiencing symptoms. That said, it's also one of the most treatable, at least in the Western world, with a series of vaccinations. These vaccinations are almost always given, even if there's a slight chance that you may have been infected, because treating rabies before it's symptomatic gives you an almost 100% survival rate. And of course, the most likely candidate to be the big pandemic to wipe out humanity is the bird flu or influenza. At the end of the Great War, the Spanish flu infected 500 million people, or 1 in 3, and likely killed more than 75 million people. And it's on that cheery note that we're going to take a little break, and we'll be back after this.
Last night, I left the bar. I was thirsty, and I don't drink wine. I was desperate. I needed blood. I turned to the only place I could. The only place that could possibly help me.
Hello, Canadian Blood Services.
Hello. I need some blood. Positive or negative, it doesn't matter.
I'm sorry, we're all out of A positive and negative. Would you like some O instead?
No. No, that won't do. Thank you. Good night. Save me. Save yourself. Give blood. Voluntarily.
This message was brought to you courtesy of the Canadian Blood Services and CITR Radio 101.9 FM.
And we're back. Beyond disease itself, one of the most interesting parts of the story is how the West has reacted to it. And that's covered in this next segment we did in episode 263. Let's listen. Yes, just when you thought we were over the highly lethal blood virus and you'd covered every bloody thing about it, the popular press finds yet another way to infect your mind with crap. Last week, we discussed a controversy that arose about how when only black people were getting ill, there was no treatment. But once a couple of white folk got sick, suddenly there was a miracle cure. Well, this week, it seems the press has taken the possibility of a vaccine and ran with it. They were not talking about if there was a cure, but how fast we could get it to the poor people of Africa, and how much was available, and can we increase production? Could this be the end of the Ebola outbreak? Well, I hate to be a stick in the mud, but there is no cure. There's no effective treatment for humans at all. Nada, bupkis. What there are experimental drugs that have shown some potential promise in animal trials. No trials in humans have ever been done, well, at least until last week, and those hardly qualify as proper trials. And for the record, what is being tried is called a serum, not really a vaccine or the like. A serum is all the parts of the blood that are not actually what we think of as blood. So blood cells, red and white, are removed, and so are the clotting factors. What you have left, among other things, and most importantly for our discussion, are antibodies. In this context, they harvest the antibodies from an infected but recovering individual, then shoot those into a sick patient. The idea is to provide what the army would call a rapid response troops in order to shore up the front lines until the body's own immune system can produce antibodies of sufficient quality on its own. Now, I'm unsure where the source of the antibodies actually come from. We must remember these are very experimental lab-based projects. Also note, I shall commit the sin of conflating serum, vaccine, and drug as sort of the same concept. I have faith in my loyal listeners that they have the intelligence to sort out what I actually mean. Okay, so who cares about all that? As I said, they were only lab-based projects that had only done some animal testing. So far, their efficacy in humans, well, there's no evidence of that at all. But you might say, Don, didn't it cure those Americans? The honest answer is who knows. It seems the lethality of this Ebola outbreak is about 75%. There were three people who have so far been given the experimental drugs. Of those, one has recovered, one is still sick, and the other has died. So there's no way of knowing if the one who's recovered wouldn't have recovered irrespective of the treatment. Now, what fueled this talk about the vaccines is the World Health Organization, or the WHO. And please, no Abbott and Costello jokes. The WHO announced that it will allow the use of experimental drugs in this current epidemic. It seems the popular press, and sadly much of the alternative press, has taken this as an endorsement of the efficacy of these treatments, which it's not. Sadly, there is likely little to no scientific or medical value in providing these drugs. It seems unlikely that there will be a miracle cure in any of them, so unless everyone who gets the treatment either survives or dies, we have no way of separating noise from science. Remember, these are experimental drugs never tested on humans, so they could do as much harm as good. And of course, it would be almost impossible to track any ill effects thanks to Ebola's rather messy MO. Because of the condition that these drugs are being used, even if they were effective in fighting Ebola, complications due to unsanitary health conditions, other factors like malnutrition, delays in application of the drugs, well, there's no way to separate positive from negative effects, if there are any effects at all. There's also the issue of getting viable serum to the patient. The drug used on the Yank needs to be kept cold at all times. Remember, these are war-torn, poverty-stricken nations. The possibility that the drugs might get warm and thus ruined is extremely high. So even if you did get a needle, you may be getting a dud anyway. Now you might ask, if they have no medical use, why did the WHO authorize their use? Well, there are two psychological reasons. The first can be found in the 75% lethality number. People know there are drugs out there. Not likely informed enough to know that they're useless, but even if they did know, Ebola is such a horrific death that any hope, however remote, is worth a try, at least from the standpoint of the patient. It's the same tendency that practitioners of WHO and charlatans use to prey upon people who are suffering from cancer or the like, and bilk them out of their last dollar by hawking some miracle cure that's nothing more than snake oil. So why give a useless drug to an infected and those at risk? One, snake oil does have one positive power, and that's the placebo effect. So essentially the WHO is prescribing West Africa, One big placebo. 2. The drug companies probably like the press, which will lead to more investment and likely tax write-offs. And 3. The West likes it because it makes it look like we care, that we're doing something, in spite of the facts on the ground. And that leads to the second psychological effect. The fact that these drugs only appeared when white people got sick. Irrespective of their effectiveness, to deny their use would make it look like blacks aren't worthy of these drugs. So in order to remove the sense of guilt that the West may have for not making these drugs available, there needed to be a grand gesture, and thus the WHO's announcement. Of course, never getting bored about talking about ourselves, the Western press quickly moved to the, quote, important issue of ethics. This issue also seems to have two main threads. One, was it ethical to treat the poor people in Africa as guinea pigs? As I have already said, there's no medical use in vaccinating these people, and the only real scientific use is to find catastrophic failures or side effects. Some people are casting this as a way for these companies to do human trials without proper consent or testing that would be mandatory before Western nations would allow these drugs to be tried. Again, because there's no real scientific value, I will for once not condemn the corporations here. But there is a subtext in all this thought with regards to consent. If one reads between the lines, you find that, based on the reporting, people in Africa are too poor, illiterate, and, well, too stupid, their sentiment, not mine, for anyone there to provide proper consent. To be sure, there is little education, the region has suffered several wars, and there are a lot of people who believe in magic. We talked on the show before about witch hunting and people burned at the stake. That said, most Americans believe in ghosts, and even in Canada, we have an exorcism or two. So casting stones in glass houses, not a smart thing. Yes, I'm looking at you, Tea Party. Put the rock down. Anyway, what this does show is what might qualify as racism, or at least stereotyping. There is an implied sentiment that in these countries, no one is capable of giving informed consent. An interesting, though sad thing, is that prior to the Americans getting the drug, Sheikh Hamar Khan, a prominent Sierra Leone doctor who was a major actor on the front line in trying to control the disease, was himself infected. There was much debate amongst his doctors whether to give him the serum or not. They decided that the risk of an untested drug was too great, although he did eventually die a few days later from Ebola. But there you have it. The people who would most likely receive the drugs would be the doctors and nurses manning the front line, those most at risk and most needed to fight the epidemic. These people are well-educated professionals, and to imply that just because it's Africa, that it would be impossible to find anyone smart enough, well, that's just sad. What is saddest of all is while the drugs have dominated media coverage, the real need, the real story, the thing we could do to help is being ignored. I listened to a couple of interviews by individuals who are working with people on the front line, and they all say the same thing. Shut up about the drugs. What we need is help, people, supplies. One of the major reasons this outbreak is so much worse than previous ones is location. In the past, Ebola had the decency to only appear in isolated, sparsely populated areas where containment and quarantine were relatively easy. This outbreak is in the middle of a highly mobile, densely populated urban environment. This is why the disease has spread across 3, maybe 4 borders. So far, the only major actor has been Doctors Without Borders, and they have said that they've exhausted their resources. According to the Council of Foreign Relations, there are about 50 doctors left in Liberia, a nation of 4 million, to fight this epidemic. And to make things even better, in Nigeria, the likely next front in the war of Ebola, the health minister just fired 16,000 doctors who went on strike. These numbers not only make treatment difficult, but one of the important activities is to ensure containment, is to find out who contacted who. You need to round up everyone and isolate them, or the disease will continue to spread. There are two stories that help exemplify the need and the problem with containment. The first case is in Nigeria with Patrick Sawyer, a Liberian who knowingly left his homeland and traveled to Lagos because he had no faith in his own country's health system and thought he would get better treatment in Nigeria. He knew he was sick. He was desperate. He got onto a plane, taking care, thankfully, not to contact anyone on the plane, and handed himself over to authorities in Lagos, wanting to be taken to one of their hospitals for treatment. Then it turns out one of the nurses treating Patrick, for fear of her life, escaped quarantine and returned to her home village, where she may have contaminated over 100 people. Fortunately, none seemed to be infected. Chalk one up to luck. Another major issue just occurred was the sacking of an Ebola treatment center. Members of a slum in Monrovia were not convinced that Ebola was real and saw it as a way for the government to remove their shantytown. Others thought it was a plot by the government to infect the poor to get rid of them. Regardless of why, a mob not only forced the patients to run for their life, but they also stole everything in sight, including soiled bedding, mattresses, contaminated medical equipment, and the like. Experts are now expecting a major outbreak in the slum in the upcoming weeks, in an area where hygiene is already non-existent. Couple that with an infrastructure where services like running water is hard to come by, even in a hospital. Say you get all the infected into hospitals. Those taking care of them are likely to come in contact and spread the disease for no other reason than lack of proper medical supplies, like said water, or gloves, or bedding, or, well, you get the point. So if the West, the world, really wanted to help, they would stop wasting breath on non-existent miracle vaccines. They would send in medical personnel and supplies to make a real difference. I find it funny, in a not really funny way, that Obama, reluctantly but consistently, was able to find the time to bomb people in Iraq for humanitarian reasons, but seems incapable of sending in a platoon of medics to help fight the Ebola epidemic. If you'd like to make a difference, please go to msf.ca, that's the Doctors Without Borders website, and give. Contact your local MP and say, hey, it's great we're giving drugs that don't work, that we have sent 3 shipments of aid to the Ukraine, spent millions of aid to Iraq, but what about sending some of those peacekeepers we used to be proud about to help contain the outbreak? Provide clean water, doctors, field hospitals that can actually quarantine people. I am pleased that the press have not yet bored of the Ebola epidemic like it has with Gaza, Libya, and oh yes, anyone remember Syria? That's still going on. However imperfect, at least we are aware and can do something. So get off your arse now and do something. We'll be back after this break. And we're back. Now, I promised you a bit of an update before we moved on. So we've reached 2 rather large milestones since I did the last episode on Ebola. The most notable of them is that we not only had the first case arising in the U.S., that from the Liberian who came by airplane already infected, but more importantly, or more scarily, let me take that back. I don't think it's more scarily. I think the press has made it a greater fear factor than it really is. But it is notable that we now have 2 cases, one in the U.S. and one in Spain, that were not contracted in Africa, but were contracted from dealing with patients in the Western world, Spain and U.S. respectively. Now, some people have said, oh no, this shows that our system can't handle an Ebola-type outbreak, that it's only a matter of time before it comes here, and we will, if only through ineptitude, allow it to spread and become a pandemic here in the West. To that I have to say, hogwash. Okay, so some people were a little bit careless. But again, one of the things that we have to remember is that we don't really have any experience with Ebola in the West. It's not something that happens here. So people who take shortcuts, who are not very attentive, well, these mistakes are going to happen. And that I think is what's happened with these 2 particular cases in Spain and the U.S. On to that, again, the awareness that this is a ongoing, growing problem in Africa has gone unnoticed in the West, at least in a very fundamental way, at least in the West, because you had a gentleman who said, hey, I just came from West Africa, I have these symptoms, and these symptoms are well known to be symptoms with Ebola, and what did the hospital in Texas do? They sent him home. In fact, the only way that he ended up getting treatment was, according to some reports, a call to the CDC saying, hey, we think our friend here has Ebola. And just to get a little dig in, I'm sure the fact that he didn't have health insurance had nothing to do with the fact that they sent him home. It is a curious fact to note that
The nurse in Spain wasn't sent home, and I'm wondering what would happen if it had happened here in Canada, but that's a conversation for another day. And then you had, of course, medical professionals, and I'm going to put that in quotes because, again, there are a lot of cutbacks to healthcare that may mean these people may or may not have been either underprotected, undereducated, underqualified, but they then became infected from treating this particular patient. But what happened next is the part that really should stand out, is then there was a mobilization. A, the CDC and other health agencies put the alert out saying, hey folks, you really got to be on the lookout for these particular cases because they're going to be more and more likely showing up as the number of people in Africa that become exposed and infected increases exponentially, which is a whole thing unto itself, but I'll talk about that later. But you can't just sit back and pretend, you can't just pretend that it's something that only happens over there. It can happen here, especially with the interconnectivity that we have of the world's traveling. But another thing that we can take solace in is that once we sort of identified, hey, this person had Ebola and this person got Ebola, is the system swung into action and said, hey, who have you had contact with? Where have you been? What is the possibilities? What are the permeations that this could have spread to other people? And then those people in turn were put into quarantines and by all accounts with no problems, you know, like they weren't sitting there saying, oh, this is a government plot or anything. People said, oh, I have this thing and it's better that I stay quarantined. And most of them seem to be going by it because we have a very different sort of social climate than you get in these other countries where there's a lot of resentment, no, fear, justifiable fear, legitimate, oh my God, the government's going to kill me type fear that you have in these other countries because of their war-torn areas. So although it is likely, I'm going to say likely now, that there will be more cases of Ebola showing up in the Western world. I think 90% of them will be people who contracted it in Africa and brought it to the West. There will be a small number who will have contracted from these people. And I'm almost willing to bet that no one will be the person who contracted it from someone who contracted it from someone who contracted it from West Africa. All that being said, there is still the elephant in the room. If you remember before, I said that the infection rate and the number of people who are falling ill to this is growing exponentially. When I first reported this, there were some people who were saying that, hey, this Ebola crisis could hit hundreds of thousands of people before we finally get sort of a cap on it. And now people are saying that it may actually be closer to 500,000 or 1,000,000. And sadly, those predictions seem to be the more accurate and true predictions of what's going on. When I first reported about this, the infection rate was about 2,000, death toll was about 1,000. Currently, we're at four times that number in just a few short weeks. Not a lot of people know, but this outbreak actually started in December of last year. By March, it had elevated to about 35 cases, which is really sort of the peak point for most of these outbreaks. By July, it had raised to about 200, and no one's really sure where it's going to end, as I've already sort of said. In spite of all that is going on, the response to this humanitarian crisis, this potentially, well, I was going to say globally damaging, but again, I don't want to be that fearmonger. This is really going to crush West Africa. And for you and me, that could be devastating for us because although right now it's only in Ghana, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, right next door to it is Ivory Coast and Ghana and Cameroon. And these places account for like 2/3 of all the chocolate made in the world. Oh my God, there could be no chocolate if this Ebola epidemic isn't quashed. If that doesn't give you motivation to try and pressure the government to do more. I mean, damn, we are spending more trying to bomb a make-believe threat in Iraq and Syria, ISIS, than we are trying to save tens of thousands of lives in Africa. It's nuts. Well, that's all I'm going to add for this bit today. When we come back, a bit more of the best of Radio Freethinker.
After decades of decline, drowning fatalities have been rising dramatically in Canada since 2004. Most drowning victims had no intention of going in the water, and harmless situations can become dangerous quickly. This summer, if you're going out on the water, even if you're not planning on going in it, be water smart and be prepared. Here are some things you can do to reduce your risk of drowning. learn to swim and swim to survive. If you can tread water for a minute, you can orient yourself, and if you can swim 50 meters in a pool, you'll most likely be able to swim to safety in open water. Most drowning fatalities occur within just 15 meters of safety. Wear a life jacket or personal flotation device. 80% of all boating deaths were people who were not wearing one. Take a marine safety course, and if you're going kayaking or canoeing, know how to get out of your craft if it flips over. Practice basic safety moves such as wet exits and self-rescues. Save the alcohol for dry land after you're done playing on the water. And never go out alone. For more information and more safety tips, go to lifesaving.bc.ca.
And we're back. Currently in the news is ISIS. And no, we're not talking about Archer's place of employment, a little Easter egg for my more hipper listeners. But seriously, it's damn near impossible to watch television and not hear something about the pending Armageddon proffered by ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, aka ISIL, the Islamic State in the Levant. ISIS has, in a few short weeks, managed to capture the headlines, driving previous boogeymen like Al-Qaeda out of our mind. They have gone from a small faction fighting in Syria to become, quote, the new bully state on the block when they declared the Islamic State, which accompanies the Sunni parts of Iraq, parts of southern Syria, and some other little bits. So who are they? Well, the simple answer is, they're a radical Sunni militia. They've been around for at least 7 years, where in 2007 they stated that they wished to abolish the modern notion of the nation-state. By calling their land the Islamic State, they are harkening back to a time of the caliphates in the 10th and 15th century. But their thinking is much more revolutionary and modern than that. Not so much a devolution of the idea of a nation, but an evolution of the idea of Islam. The leader is one Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who called himself Emir or Prince, first of the Islamic State of Iraq, then the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and now simply the Emir of the Islamic State. With each new pronouncement, he is attempting to create an Islamic State which, at its minimum, includes the historical Islamic Empire, with its goal being that Islam will eventually be the true religion of all people and thus encompass the gold. With regards to the global Islamic State, whether it can be interpreted as a conquest by force or an act of religious conversion is of little import, as the global Islamic State is but a pipe dream. Sorry, my Muslim friends. The original fighting force of the ISIS has been estimated at just a few thousand, but those numbers have ballooned as ISIS have achieved more success and legitimacy. The ballooning of their ranks and the expansion of the territory they cover is tied with the success they've had in the region, obviously. But why or how have they succeeded when other competing militias have not gained similar success? Well, on the one hand, some have achieved similar success. As a constant counterpoint to ISIS, there's been the Kurds. They have not only gained control of a large territory, established an independent-ish government, but they've united a people. So in many ways, they are no different than the Islamic State, except they've been around a little longer, and, well, we seem to like them. And it is this united people that help us understand the success of ISIS in the land it controls. Why has ISIS achieved success? The most obvious answer is that they have the support of the local people. Why? Well, this requires us to understand that Iraq is under the control of a Shiite government. Although ostensibly a coalition government, it's really Shiite control. In the past few months, many headlines noted troubles with al-Maliki's leadership, that because of his efforts over the past 8 years, he has secularized both the government and the security forces. When you think of security forces, think of sort of a cross between the CIA and the movie version of the KGB. Anyway, essentially he has made it a Shiite force with an overt intent of suppressing all things Sunni. It's like an act of revenge. Maliki was forced out of the government by the US and rational elements in Baghdad. His oppression of the Sunni section of Iraq has proven to be fertile grounds for groups like ISIS. From the perspective of the Sunni, however harsh ISIS rule may be, they see it as an improvement over Baghdad rule. Remember, with regards to acts of barbarism enacted by ISIS, it's been directed at non-Sunni and mainly Shiite. Retribution is a common theme in war. In oppression, under Saddam, the Sunni oppressed the Shiites. When they replaced Saddam, the Shiites enacted retribution on the Sunni. Now ISIS has created the Islamic State, and the Sunnis are enacting retribution on the Shiite. Things keep going round and round. In Syria, you have a similar situation. Assad is a member of the Alawites, a Shiite minority that has ruled and oppressed its Sunni majority. With the onset of the Syrian civil war, the violence, repression, and deteriorating living conditions have only helped drive many to anyone who could offer any relief, no matter the cost. Thus, ISIS arrives, shows it can provide peace and eliminate the Shiite oppression, and all they ask in return is the implementation of an Islamic state under Sharia law. In extreme stretching of the meaning of this term, one could argue, from the Sunni perspective, ISIS is simply preaching social justice. This also helps explain how such a small group, relatively, can control such a large area. They can call in local recruits, who have, as already mentioned, ballooning their numbers, but they have also helped by enlisting allies like Nashbandi and other former Ba'athists. ISIS has provided a revolutionary vigor, while the Ba'athists can provide not only sophisticated military knowledge and experience, but thanks to the U.S. rearming the post-Saddam army, they have access to advanced and modern armaments, as well as people able to operate and train others in their use. This is why the U.S. was reticent to provide arms to the Free Syrian Army, because there was no way to ensure that these modern effective weapons would not end up in the hands of what Obama would have called fractious anti-American or religious extremist militias, like ISIS. Well, it seems from all reports that when ISIS was confronted by the U.S.-equipped Iraqi army, they dropped their weapons and fled. Why go out and shop when they deliver? There's been many a word spent claiming that ISIS is far more barbaric than anyone else in the region. Thus, they warrant special attention. This being said in the context of the Syrian government bombing its own people with poison gas, and no, it makes little difference if you think it was a Free Syrian army that had used the poison gas. In that context, beheading a couple of people and a few deaths of unarmed soldiers seems pretty weak tea. And the fact that I can call that weak tea speaks more to the tragic conditions in the region and not of the acceptability of those actions. That said, why might the ISIS leadership be more radical, more violent, more barbaric than previous leaderships? On the one hand, thanks to the oppression this region has been under, combined with the ongoing civil war, the moderates, those willing to compromise, well, they found themselves betrayed and have literally been killed off. There are no moderates left to deal with. What you have now is not the best and the brightest. Those who have acted most ruthlessly and thus out-survived their rivals. But there's more than just attrition to this leadership. So there's more to the radicalization of leadership than just attrition of leadership. These are all war-torn areas, which helps explain the, quote, radical and extreme nature of these groups and their leaders. We think the beheading of two journalists and one aid worker barbaric, but if you lived in a land where people are routinely rounded up off the streets, imprisoned, tortured, killed, where you live with the daily possibility of being beheaded by U.S. drones, to be constantly surrounded by death, destruction, and violence, well, how else can I put this? We often decry the treatment our troops receive when they return from places like Afghanistan. Many of them suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. This leads many of them to substance abuse, violent behavior, and well, they are, if I can use this term to make a point in a moment, a little nuts. Think then what it must be like to have grown up under these conditions. From our perspective, in the safe comfort of our living room, many if not most of the leadership of the rank and file of groups like ISIS, due at least to post-traumatic stress disorder, are nuts, some more so than others. This leads to a surreal event like Al-Qaeda disowning ISIS because they think ISIS is too violent. The people claiming responsibility for 9/11 thinking ISIS techniques are too over the top. So much so that in an effort to distance themselves from ISIS and show they are the saner terrorist group, after the beheading of Stephen Sadcloth, they made a big show of releasing one of their captives, Peter Curtis, as a peace offering, I guess, or a gesture of saying something like, "Hey America, even to us, those ISIS dudes, they're way too crazy." And that actually brings up an interesting point. A major difference in the comparison between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. The fact ISIS proclaimed the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda makes no claim to nationhood. They're more of a methods group, using terrorism to, from their perspective, defend Islam and the Holy Lands. ISIS has set itself up as the endpoint, not the method, but the goal, the Islamic State. One way this difference has been articulated in how they treat their foreign recruits. When people join Al-Qaeda, the real prize from Al-Qaeda are their passports. Why? Because passports are tickets back into the West, where they could carry out terrorist acts. This is gold if you wish to commit acts of terror on other nations. This is the raison d'etre of Al-Qaeda. But what is the first thing you see Westerners who join ISIS do? They burn their passports. Why? Because it shows a rejection of the West, a refutation of the old and an embracement of the new, in this case, the Islamic State. ISIS has made no claims or threat against the West. Their use of terror is limited to the lands they wish to control. They have no point to make other than the establishment of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, for now at least. And in that, there's an important clue, Iraq and Syria. Al-Qaeda has Al-Qaeda in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in Maghreb, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, each tied to a nation. They just announced Al-Qaeda in India. Most, if not all, jihadi groups are acting with a national mindset. IS was proclaimed as a borderless nation, that it does not recognize national borders, that Muslims should live in one land of Islam. And that is a radical and revolutionary idea. What, you missed the point? Well, in the news, and often touted by prominent anti-Islam atheists, that what these terrorists, Islamists, jihadist types are trying to do is drag the world back to the 10th century, that they are ultra-conservative traditionalists. Well, folks, they're not. It's better to think of them as revolutionaries. They reject the traditional casual view of the religion of their parents. They do not want to return to some historical decadent period to be recast, but to create a new world where the true caliphate can live. It's akin to fundamentalist Christians who are not wanting to return to the time of Jesus, but create a new heaven on earth. They do not want to use imposed imperialist ideas of empire and nation, but they see a new Islamic State as a theocracy, God-inspired, global state, where the forces required to educate the infidel is, well, soft-pedaled, but neither is it fundamental to ISIS doctrine. These people see how their elders have allowed the Arab world to be manipulated by infidels. They are rejecting the idea of nations. By erasing the borders in the Middle East imposed by Western imperialists, they are creating a single Islamic State that they would see one day as encompassing the world, one world united under Allah, if you will. This is a radical generational shift as power in the community moves from parents to youth. It is an anti-traditional movement. It is not hard to see parallels with the social unrest of the 1960s, where you had generations of youth looking at the society they lived in and found it wanting, found it corrupt, and found themselves with nothing to believe in. In the 1960s, some focused on liberation and social justice. Some focused on anarchy and religious radicalism. Scientology, the explosion of the Hare Krishnas, cults like Jim Jones were birthed during the 70s and 60s. Revolutionary radical religion is not unique to Islam or the modern world. We see with things like the Arab Spring that youth in Muslim nations have a similar reaction, a cry for freedom and social justice. Sadly, we also see some being radicalized, falling under the sway of violent demagogues who use their longing for change and their need for belonging in creating groups like ISIS. Or if you're a Christian, the Christian Front, the Minutemen, or the Aryan Nation, just to kind of bring this idea home. One author who dismisses the correlation with jihadists and ISIS in particular with medievalism say ISIS is less a recreation of the Umayyad Caliphate, but is owing more to the French Revolution. Republican France was birthed on the idea of a state founded on a set of principles, and thus ISIS is not a wholly new thing in this world. In revolutionary France, it is the state that creates its citizens, and nothing should be allowed to stand between the citizen and the state. Republican France was based on the principles of the Enlightenment. ISIS is founded on the principles of Islam. Just as a revolutionary French state creates its citizens with the citizen unthinkable outside the state, so too the Islamic State creates its citizen with their existence outside of Islam unthinkable. So claims that this group wants to return to the good old days is to fundamentally misunderstand their message. Yes, they wish to live under a strict form of Sharia law, but not like in the past, but in a new way, in a new Islamic state. Okay, that's enough about them. Let's go to the, quote, important question, the one that has exploded over the popular press. Should we be afraid? That depends on who the we are. One of the things that has made ICE's headline news is both its rapid growth, but also its moved beyond a militia and are beginning to have the features of a government. They, obviously for reasons of indoctrination, are setting up and reopening schools. They provide a respectable police. They've restored running water and turned on the lights in areas that haven't seen them for years. In fact, one of the reasons we know the extent of ICE's control is they have a well-disciplined border customs. People entering ICE's territory have their passport or papers stamped. They excise tax or custom duties. They are no longer your typical guys with guns on the side of the road shaking down people for money. No, these are more akin to Canadian customs. We also know that they are trading with other nations and groups for things like oil, including, ironically enough, Syria. So if the we are those people under the control of ISIS, well, many of them have lived for years in the wreckage of the U.S. invasion. Being the Sunni part of Iraq, they have experienced discrimination and downright hostility from the Shiite-controlled government. We already discussed al-Maliki was forced to step down because much of the blame for the rise of ISIS is leveled at his harsh treatment of Sunnis in their region. So the people living in ISIS territory have a simple question. Do they want to live under the control of a distant government that is hostile, Iraq, or actively violent, Syria? Would you? Do they want to live in a place that, because of the constant violence, remains largely in ruins? That because of the absence of any good government, they live under near lawless conditions? Would you wish to continue to live under Damascus or Baghdad? Or would you prefer to live under a law and order government, one that has ended the persecution for at least your people, i.e. the Sunni? One where you can feel safe walking the streets at night, where you have the return of running water, power, and the restoration of infrastructure, the reopening of schools, something as simple as having someone control traffic in the streets, to live a more or less normal, if much more pious, life. It was these same conditions that led to the rise of the Taliban in Afghanistan, a trick they look like they're about to repeat. No, if you were Sunni living under ISIS, you might well not fear, but actually welcome ISIS and see them as more liberators. So it seems like if you were living under the ISIS government, you wouldn't have that much to fear, again, assuming you're a Sunni. If you're not a Sunni, get the hell out. But that leads open to the next question. What about the neighbors? What about the people who are living around the Islamic State? What do they have to fear? We'll answer that question when we come back after this break.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding
the To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
Okay, so we were just talking about what it's like to live under the ISIS leadership. Okay, so it's great for them. But people in the West never really seem to care about anything beyond their own concerns. To the really important question, if I may channel your typical Westerner, what threat are they to me here in Canada, the US, or wherever in the quote West? One thing to note, regardless of the current headlines, ISIS has been gaining strength for a couple of years. They had a big splash when they captured Mosul and started the inevitable fall of al-Maliki. But they were not an existential threat until the beheading of the U.S. journalists. This was taken by the war hawks, the popular media, and opportunists to be a threat to the United States. First the journalists, then you. No one is safe. Nothing is sacred. More nuanced analysts believe the very visible, deliberate, orchestrated message was really to tell the West, and more specifically the U.S., to back off. You're not welcome here, and if you come, this is what you can expect. It was not a threat, but a warning. Sadly? I think I mean sadly. I'm not sure on that. But irrespective, they misjudged. I think they assumed that if they gave the U.S. a little push, it would do what it's been doing for almost a decade now in the region. Try to further disengage. That Obama was milquetoast and would say that there was a red line, make a lot of noise, but ultimately do nothing. And that may have been the case had they done almost anything else. But the U.S. psyche is a tricky beast. The beheadings have triggered America's PTSD over 9/11. And instead of kicking the sleeping bear's arse, they poked it in the eye. The very act they hope to reduce U.S. involvement has caused a marked increase in U.S. engagement that may ultimately lead to the reintroduction of ground troops. Our own trigger-happy militarist government has already committed Canadian Special Forces to the battle. Of course, I have not actually answered the question. Should we, here in Canada, the U.S., the U.K., be afraid? Is ISIS the new, more radical Al-Qaeda? The short answer is no. Al-Qaeda's raison d'etre was to drive the U.S. out of Saudi Arabia by bringing the wars of the Middle East to the shores of America. And that's how you got 9/11, 7/7, and 3/11. ISIS, though, more specifically the Islamic State, has no real truck with the U.S. or the West in general. The area they set up shop is relatively free of Western interest. In fact, if they had not done the beheadings, they would likely have been able to continue to set up shop provided their expansion was contained, which, as we've already discussed, it largely had been. It would, as I already said, be a repeat of the Taliban in Afghanistan. ISIS has no history of terror attacks of the kind we should be worried about. They used terror, no one can deny the beheadings were an act of terror, but exercised within the state, or should I say quasi-state. They have, as yet, no message to send to the U.S., no grievance with them. Unlike groups like Al-Qaeda, and again, emphasis on as yet. Their focus is solidifying their new nation, attacking Assad in Syria, repelling the Kurds and Shiite in Iraq. In all that, the U.S. is a sideshow for them. Okay, there is one important question we've yet to ask. Not that we should fear from ISIS, but what we should fear from the U.S. response to ISIS. It is often a sad tragedy that the effects of American reaction has a greater deleterious effect than the act that actually prompted it. It is the irony of the American post 9/11 PTSD that have blown up the important and dangers of ISIS, that they will in earnest step up their military campaign. The U.S. thinks they can use their planes and drones to beat down the Islamists, define that as you may, that it will stop popular support of these radicals who are in control of their land. Yet what happened when the U.S. suffered a one-day attack from the sky? It united the U.S. in a vengeful mandate where they willingly handed over all power to cabal of radical militarists, the Bush cadre. What effect would living under years of attacks do to a person, a people? The only threat that ISIS poses to the West is the threat we ourselves create. I am sure at some point someone or more people suffering under yet another military campaign by the West on a Muslim country will actually hear what some American war hawks say. Do you remember that line? If we don't fight them there on their land, we will end up having to fight them here on our own. Well, at some juncture, there will be a breaking point. A point where it will not be our radicals, but their radicals saying, hey, that's right. If we start to regularly attack the U.S. on American soil, they'll no longer be focused on the Middle East, but on themselves. Then you'll see terrorism like the U.K. suffered under the IRA, where you really had to look under your bed every night. So we're going to go for a little break. When we come back, we're going to talk not so much about ISIS, but the impact of Obama in his reaction to ISIS and the West's reaction to ISIS. Are we turning a molehill into a mountain? We'll return after this break.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try, anyway. Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Okay, we're back. We seem to have gone over a lot of the complexity of the issue. Irrespective of the complexity, it seems Obama has yet again shat on the Nobel Peace Prize he won just after becoming president. Why would I say this? Well, it seems in response to ISIS, Obama originally stated that it was largely a local issue and that it was best for the U.S. to take a wait-and-see attitude. This was exemplified by the comments Obama made at one press conference where he stated that he had no strategy to deal with ISIS. However, after the very public beheading of two journalists and a huge swing in public opinion, it appears Obama has found a strategy, and that is to make the next greatest threat to the U.S. So let's take a quick look at what he plans to do with ISIS. He stated that he will employ the same strategy that he has, in his words, worked so well in Yemen and Somalia. Somalia? The poster child for failed states? He pledged to do more airstrikes, and this is likely to include drone assassinations. How effective this would be on an army that is now reported to be anywhere from 20 to 80,000? Not all ISIS, but supporters of the Islamic State. Obama's airstrikes in Yemen and Somalia happen a couple times a year. At its peak, maybe a couple times a month. Regardless, it's not likely to have an impact at hurting such a large army. Now, to be fair, the highly centralized nature of ISIS does give the strategy of, quote, cut off the head and kill the monster, more credence. But not dealing with the underlying issues we have already discussed, it seems like, as any Hydra, a new and more radical head will step in to fill the vacuum. Now, they could provide classic air support, take out artillery or tank, but there are a few of those actually being used. And even if you do destroy a tank, you haven't actually taken the land. So air support without boots on the ground seems pointless. Now, the Peshmerga of the Kurds can and have offered resistance, and with air support have retarded ISIS advancements into Kurdistan. But they have no desire to take on ISIS beyond their own lands. There is the Iraqi army, which has already been defeated by ISIS. And by defeated, from most reports, the Iraqi army just threw down their arms and ran away or switched sides. Again, because of the sectarian tensions, Shiites are not willing to defend Sunni lands, and Sunni soldiers are more likely to choose to join ISIS. Obama says he will send in advisors to help train the Iraqi forces and arms to help equip them. Which sounds nice until you remember that the US has already been doing that for over a decade. That if they could not get the Iraqi army trained in that time frame, what could they possibly do now? Some fear that the U.S. may be drawn in. I should note that Canadian Special Forces are already on the ground, but although there is a lot of support now for the U.S. involvement in suppressing ISIS, there is still no support for sending in troops. Obama, in an eerie echo of Bush, has called together a coalition of the willing, so perhaps France or Canadian troops will be drawn into this quagmire. A quagmire we were smart enough to avoid the first time around, but it seems Harper likes to play in quagmires, irrespective of what may happen to our troops or our nations. Why a quagmire? Well, I repeat and remind that the U.S. occupied this region for about a decade and seems to have had no long-lasting positive effect. What a repeat could accomplish, I'm unsure. So there you have it. Ebola, something that I'm sure we're going to be listening to much more in the future as the pandemic grows in Africa and people become more hysterical about it here in the West. But remember, we don't need to worry about it here. We need to worry about it there, and we need to help. And ISIS, the paper dragon that's becoming a real threat to the West, not because they are a threat, but because our reaction to them threatens to harm ourselves and to foster the very thing we fear the most. Attacks in the West. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on, and keep on listening to Radio Freethinker.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion.